Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Christopher Lord. On today's show, we're going to get to grips with some of November's literature releases, and joining me in the studio are two experts on the matter. Sarah Shaffy, online editor for The Bookseller, and to my right, Anne Meadows, commissioning editor for Granta and Portobello Books. Welcome both of you to the programme. They've brought in some of their picks for where you should be putting your nose this autumn. Later on in the programme, we'll be heading to Buenos Aires, where a number of new initiatives are taking place to boost the city's art scene. But is it enough? Our reporters go to find out. And of course, no edition of the Monocle Arts Review would be complete without Fernando Augusto Pacheco's Global Countdown. All that and more to come on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Chris Lord. So Sarah and Anne, welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. We're going to start with Celeste Ng's Little Fires Everywhere. It's our first book for discussion. And this is a follow-up to the American author's best-selling 2014 debut, Everything I Never Told You. And it begins with this fire in a house in Ohio. Sarah, is that the fire being referred to in the title here?
I mean, I guess so, but I think there are lots of little fires throughout the book that are less literal than an actual house on fire. So you begin right at the end of the story and then track back and find out how we got to that house in a very nice suburb in Ohio being set on fire.
And so just give us a, without giving too much away, a bit of an overview of if, especially if it's running backwards, what do we start to know in those first few chapters about what led to that fire?
So we meet a family, a very nice suburban family, a number of kids, mum, dad, both very successful, affluent. And we meet a few of them, but we don't meet all of the family. And what we're told is that there is, I guess, a black sheep in the family, the youngest girl, who is possibly involved in this fire. And then we track backwards and find how she got to that point, but also how the rest of her family got to that point as well.
So is, you know, you're talking there about affluent family, nice suburban middle class environment, and then this, what I get a sense of, a sort of underlying little fire of resentments possibly, or internal strife within the family. To what extent is this a kind of, is there some critique here of this sort of suburban world? Is that a key part of the novel?
Yeah, so the action of the novel really kicks off when two people, a mother and a daughter, move into a house that belongs to this family. They're renting from this family and they are very different. They are from a completely different ethnic background. They have lived in many different places. They move pretty much every year. And so they really throw kind of a wrench in this family's life. Everyone in the family forms a relationship with either the mother, Mia, or with her daughter. And it's about the way those relationships affect this family's outlook on life. And then there's another incident within the book where another affluent couple are in the process of adopting a Chinese American baby, and the couple is white. So there's some tension there, and people start on one side of that argument of who, whether they think this couple should adopt this baby or whether they think they shouldn't. And lots of people change their minds as more facts come to light and more kind of it becomes more emotive as the book goes on.
Now you've got this intersection of these various families all meeting on the street and kind of around this house almost. How is that handled by Celeste Ng? Is it successfully done? There's a lot of different personalities here. Can she balance it out?
Absolutely. She's got a great style. So sometimes you're right there in the midst of the action, and other times, so with this case of the family adoption, there is a large court case kind of about two-thirds of the way through the book, and you're told that almost in the style of a newspaper report, but almost in the style of kind of here's the neighbourhood gossiping about it, and this is how they would have been told about what happened in the courtroom that day. And it's such a cliche to say, but it's so readable. She handles things extremely well, and you just want to, you're kind of comfortable with the characters from the off, and you just want to carry on and keep going and see where they end up.
Everything I Never Told You? Did you read that?
I did.
And how does this match up? I mean, does it succeed as a second book? Is it successful?
Yeah, I really enjoyed Everything I Never Told You, but I really loved this book. And I think there's similar themes that are dealt with, so themes of belonging and identity, of where you fit into the world. Everything I Never Told You also dealt with families, and within those families, teenagers. So it's about finding your place. I just think this book is on another level from her first release, and you know, is being released here now. It was originally supposed to be in January, but the American release proved so successful that the UK publisher decided to bring it forward.
To try and nip it in before Christmas. Yeah. But that structure, that idea of beginning with your climax, you know, you've got the fire that opens it there. When it pulls out from that and we see everything before, does it work? I mean, does that feel like a tired formula? Does it feel like something that's sort of been, it's been done a million times before? Or does it feel like she sort of covers some new ground with that?
No, I think she does cover new ground. I think it's one thing to know how something ends, but the fascinating part is how you get there. And I think she's really good at the how you get there part.
Well, that's Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng, which is out now, published by Little Brown. Our next book, Women and Power, A Manifesto, is Mary Beard's exploration of how history has treated powerful women. Taking examples from the classical world to the modern day, she considers the ways in which women are talked about and dealt with when in a position of authority. So it's quite a timely release, this, I would say, Anne. With so much talk at the moment, you know, right here in the UK, we're talking about allegations of sexual misconduct in the Houses of Parliament, in the Halls of Power. Does she think that we've made progress here? When she goes right back to that early, you know, as we talked about there in the days of antiquity, so right now where we're what we're talking about, does it seem like there's some sort of positive trajectory that Mary Beard finds in?
Absolutely. I think Mary Beard is such an interesting writer. I mean, she's known as a classicist and she's been called Britain's most famous classicist, largely because of her sort of TV and media experience, but also because she's known for taking on her Twitter trolls. And Mary Beard is someone who is repeatedly trolled online. She's insulted. She's receives death threats and rape threats, and people referring to her genitalia as rotten fruit and all these things. And she talks about this in the book. She talks about this space that she encounters online where men seek to repeatedly take away her authority. And I think she would say, and it's very clear, you know, that the modern world is better for women than the classical world. You know, we can vote, we can hold down jobs, we're no longer sort of chattels or property. But at the same time, what Mary Beard does in this book, which is so interesting, is that she looks at the kind of silencing that happened in ancient Rome particularly, and how similar it is to the silencing that happens now. So she talks about how Hillary Clinton and Angela Merkel and Theresa May have all been depicted in sort of posters as the head of Medusa, like this very classical image of a powerful woman brought down by male violence. So although things are better now, we're still using the same ways of getting at women. We're still saying, oh, but you don't really have the intelligence to hold power, or oh, but surely you know, your femininity will get in the way. So she looks at the ways in which women are still negotiating kind of the same old bullshit.
Which, from what I understand what you just said, I mean, essentially that bullshit that she's exploring there is the idea that once you have some kind of power, the way you are then addressed or talked to then becomes a way of silencing you through public discourse. Like you say, you talked about Twitter, but then also there are echoes of that right back to antiquity.
Absolutely. And one of the most interesting examples she gives in the book is the beginning of the Odyssey. So in the beginning of the Odyssey, Penelope comes down and says, you know, you guys are cluttering up my house. And Telemachus, her son, turns around and is like, you know, be quiet, mother, and go back upstairs. And she does. And this is seen in the Odyssey as a sign of Telemachus kind of growing up and becoming manly. So male authority is literally based on suppressing the female. And she says that, you know, powerful female women in antiquity were seen as no longer female. Like, to speak was meant you were being sort of unsexed, you were becoming masculine, you were becoming a monster. And you see that now with the ways in which politicians are addressed and treated.
Absolutely. I mean, and that silencing as well, in the case of Medusa, which you talked about before, I mean, physically removing the head at the end of the story, of course, is silencing it completely. But how is it built, this story? I mean, this work by Mary Beard, is it sort of a narrative, a sequential narrative? Is it organised? How is it structured?
So it's based on two lectures that Mary Beard gave in 2014 for the London Review of Books, which means that it has a very kind of discursive, free-flowing and very approachable style. I mean, I have read SPQR, Mary Beard's book on ancient Rome, and I had to sort of concentrate very hard. And, you know, she's a classical scholar. There's so much in her brain at all times that you have to be in a particular mood, I think, for some of her nonfiction. But this book, I mean, I would give it to anyone. It's very accessible.
Sarah, you've obviously read through this as well. And yeah. I wondered, you know, as a female reader, someone who may have experienced some of what we've just been talking about, What do you take away from a book like this? What did you, when you were reading it, what did you sort of glean about maybe even the way forward for women in the future?
So when I read it, I devoured it. It is quite a short book, and like Anne says, because it's essays that were delivered as lectures, it's very easy to read. I did feel quite powerful at the end of it because I felt like I was kind of armed and with things that I already probably knew in the back of my mind about how women are silenced on a day-to-day basis, but having it written down there and having being told that it goes back thousands of years was just fascinating. And I really came out of reading it feeling like, right, we've got to do something about this. And there are women doing something about this.
Do you agree with that? And do you agree with that point? This idea that once a sort of trajectory is drawn and you can see that, like, these connections that you've just been talking about, that actually it can be quite empowering a feeling.
I think it's definitely empowering. I mean, one of the other interesting things that Mary Beard says at the end of this book, and I don't know what Sarah thought, but I thought it was almost kind of like a teaser. She says that actually we can't just change things for individual women. We need to look at this structure of power. And she cites the Black Lives Matter movement, which was set up by three women, but which gave voice to so many people. And actually, it was a collective kind of power. It wasn't based on one person and personality politics or public persona. It was based on a group of people sort of seizing power and utilizing it. And she says that until we rethink the structures of power, misogyny will continue. I sort of wanted her to explore that a bit more because it's really just a paragraph in the book and you're like, oh my God, that's amazing.
This idea of sort of power being moderated by a group essentially rather than concentrated in one individual.
I think so. Shared or just power being a sort of free-flowing thing rather than something you can grab and hold. Like she talks about making it a verb and having to power.
Well, Women in Power by Mary Beard is out now and published by Profile. And now to a memoir in the form of Kuz by Danielle Allen. Allen is a professor at Harvard University and widely known for her work in justice and citizenship. In Kuz, she tells us the story of her cousin, Michael. He was sentenced to a long prison term for carjacking when he was 15. Shortly after his release, was found shot dead in a car park. Sarah, this book isn't just the retelling of Michael's life, is it really? It's Allen's opportunity to sort of ask why about his crime.
Yeah, absolutely. So you do get the story of what happened to Michael, but it's told in a fragmented way. So the book opens with Danielle getting the call that Michael has died, and then you find out about what he did to get into prison. And he was convicted of an attempted carjacking, but it was just after California had brought in its three strikes rule. So he was sentenced to 12 years and 8 months at the age of 15 for three crimes in which he was the only person that was hurt at all. Came out of prison, he went back in, he came out, he cleared his parole, and then, like you said, a month later was found shot dead in his car. So you get all of that, but then it's an exploration of how he got to that point in terms of, was there a family situation or a kind of a community situation which led to him perhaps being vulnerable to getting into a life of crime? But then it's also an exploration of how the justice system isn't really built to help people, at least not in America, and it's really built to target already impoverished communities.
I mean, we should say that Michael is a young black man as well.
Yeah.
And for the year, obviously, that it's been in terms of that in America, in terms of regards to justice and whatnot, and police violence as well. How does she explore that justice system? What do we get from this in the end about understanding the structures of power there in America?
Yeah, so she explores kind of two structures of power. So the kind of official structures of power, the justice system, how the law works, but then also the structures of power, she calls it kind of a parastate, the power that is wielded by gangs and by powerful criminal systems that are kind of subjecting people to a rule of law that is obviously outside the law that we would abide by, but that communities have to kind of acknowledge and abide by.
To what extent is this, you know, how does she find a way to chart between being a personal memoir of someone, you know, member of her family, very, very close to her, and also a kind of system that we, you know, we talk about so much in public discourse right now. I mean, I think of, you know, the recent documentary 13, for instance, directly talking about this. But how does she skirt that distance between a kind of very personal memoir and then a more objective examination of a phenomena in society?
So I don't think she always does, which I think is a good thing. So she is an academic, so she has an academic's view of kind of how to structure something and how to write something. But I also think that, you know, I could go away and I could learn and become an expert on the American justice system and write something like this. Well, I would hope. But without that personal experience of really how it affects not just that one person that goes to jail, but their entire family, their entire community, everyone who ever knows them. And this isn't just, you know, this wasn't just Michael. This was happening to many young black men at the time and still is happening. Mm. So I think that kind of personal element really unlocks how the justice system actually works.
You know, the plot in here, if we want to talk about a plot, is that it is a quest for answers. She wants to know, why did her cousin, this young guy who wanted to be a firefighter, end up dead? Do you learn that yourself as a reader? Do you get answers?
There's no one answer. There's many different answers. There's the kind of, you know, the situation with his mum and her work life and the difficulties she went through, her kind of personal experiences, how other members of his family operated, you know, what they were doing. There's no one answer there. And it's a very powerful, devastating book. It's not necessarily going to leave you filled with hope that things are going to get better tomorrow. But that's realistic. That's the situation as it is. And until we face that, we can't improve anything.
Sarah,
else.
Just briefly, is it a successful book?
Yeah, I was left stunned by it. I think it's required reading.
Well, that's the recommendation there. Cuz by Danielle Allen is out now. Finally, we have A Cat, A Man and Two Women by the writer Yunihiro Tanizaki. The writer died in 1965, but is considered one of the giants of 20th century Japanese literature. Now, and first of all, we should say a little bit about Tanizaki. Quite a strange figure in the history of Japanese literature. He's sort of different from your Mishima, who was very tied up with Japanese nationalism and so on. Tanizaki was much more interested in aesthetics, in a slightly weirder view of Japanese life, and he's certainly been a big inspiration on someone like Murakami, for instance. First of all, just briefly, just give us a sense of what this story is about, A Cat, A Man and Two Women.
So A Cat, A Man and Two Women begins with a new wife, Fukoko, receiving a letter from her new husband's ex-wife, Shinako. And Shinako is writing to Fukoko to say, you know, you have the man I love, you have the house that I was living in, you have all of my possessions, all I want in return is the cat. And Shinako is writing, she's writing to try and get this cat, Lily, out of Fukoku and her husband Shozu's household. And her motivations are not entirely clear. I mean, does she really want the cat? Does she really care about the cat? Is she just trying to score points? Or is she, in fact, trying to destabilize her ex-husband's new marriage? And the novel goes from here, and it's so delicate and so subtle and so intensely intimate, but it just shows these four people, one of whom is a cat, kind of circling each other, and it shows the intricacies, I think, of relationships and the human heart, that, you know, we don't necessarily know what we want, and all of Tanizaki's characters are capricious, they're quite often selfish, they're all being driven by a mixture of motives that they can't fully understand. And at the centre of it is this cat, Lily, who's incredibly beautiful and sort of sensuous and moves between them, and they all of their relationships spark off her. I mean, the cat is the kind of god of the novella.
The motivator of the, yeah, is the thing at the centre of the plot. I mean, I wonder, is it written as a standard prose novella here? Because I remember Tanizaki, he did an amazing book which was called The Key, which was about a diary that a wife kept in full awareness that the husband was reading it as she had various affairs with other men, and that was all part of their sort of strange love triangle. I mean, is this written in an experimental way like that, or is this quite a standard sort of prose novella here?
No, it's a standard realist novel, although that's really interesting because one of the things I read about Tanizaki was that he wrote this essay, which I haven't been able to find, about the Japanese conception of love. And he says in this essay, as I understand it, that before the influence of Western literature, there was no such thing as as the idea of romantic love in Japan, that instead everything was erotics and power and much more primal and kind of naked. And that's definitely, it sounds like it's true of the novel you're describing, and it's definitely true of A Cat, a Man, and Two Women, that none of these characters really love each other or care for each other, although they do intensely love this small furry animal that may or may not be manipulating all three of them.
And just give us a sense, why has it taken so long for this to come to English translation?
So I think it has been published in English translation before, but it sort of slipped off the radar. And I mean, Sarah and I were talking about this. There seems to be a vogue for cat books at the moment. And
nothing to do with Japanese literature, just to do with the cats.
Possibly, very possibly. But I mean, in a way, that doesn't matter. I mean, I think it's a little masterpiece, and it's such a pleasure. You know, you're reading it and you're thinking, who will end up with a husband? You know, will it be the ex-wife who's scheming, or will it be the new wife who seems not quite as clever, but, you know, determined to quite literally keep her claws in him? And then as you read, you stop caring about the husband, who's kind of an idiot, and instead you're like, who's going to get this amazing cat?
And just give me a sense as well about Japanese literature. I mean, that, you know, I do get the sense that certainly in English we only get a kind of glancing look at the wealth of literature that comes from Japan. With this release, I mean, it's been very well promoted, and if you sort of go into most bookshops now, it's sort of got its own area and so on, and it looks quite beautiful as well. Do you think we're going to see a kind of mining process of some of the greats of contemporary and modern Japanese literature in the next few years?
I hope so. I publish quite a lot of it, and there are wonderful writers like Hiromi Kawakami and Yoko Tawada and Yoko Ogawa, who's a sort of horror writer, being published all the time. So I think there is a kind of perennial fascination in the Western world with Japanese literature, because it is so different. I mean, Tanizaki, this novel is quite straight, but if you read Murakami, obviously there are the kind of dream sequences, or if you read Ogawa, there will be bits of horror. I think that it's a literature which just seems to be doing something entirely different and fresh, and that's very exciting for readers.
So that's A Cat, a Man, and Two Women by Yunihiro Tanizaki, which is out now, published by Daunt. Sarah Shafi and Anne Meadows will be back with you shortly, but thanks for your book reviews today. Now, while we give our guests a little breather, we're going to turn our attention to Buenos Aires. The art scene has been bustling this month. Art Fair Behemoth Art Basel has begun its multi-year collaboration with the city, called the Art Basel Cities Initiative. The idea is to strengthen a city's local art scene, and they set up residences in the Argentine capital last week to host a series of events and workshops. We sent our correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, to report.
Traditionally, spring in Buenos Aires brings a whole host of cultural events. But this year, the variety on offer hit a new high with the arrival of Art Basel and international art dealers. On a wet and windy morning from the Basel City's house in the central neighbourhood of Retiro, I meet Patrick Forrett, Art Basel's Director of Business Initiatives, about the home concept.
The concept of the house in itself is quite innovative. We wanted something different than what we have at the fair with our panel discussion. So you have a series of seven living rooms where people can sit in a very relaxed way. Some people will be standing. There is not necessarily moderators during the talk, so it's two people facing each other. There is a concept of office hours, and I will be one of the speakers there, where you have 30 minutes, you go into a room, whoever is there, and you just talk. You know, so it's quite innovative, and it is about celebrating Buenos Aires and building relationships here for the art world.
Mark Spiegler, Art Basel's global director, gives little indication which city might be next on their list, but explained why a city in South America was a natural fit for the first project.
The Miami area is in many ways the de facto capital of the socioeconomic elite of Latin America. They have houses there. They have bank accounts there, they have businesses there, they have kids going to school there. So that meant that over the years, we had an ever deeper relationship with not only the existing collectors, but the developing collectors. Because what happened is people came, and unlike North America, where you have museum boards that travel in packs going to places, in Latin America, it was friendship circles. And so someone like Juan and Patricia Vergez would bring friends to Miami Beach, and the friends would come socially, but then they would see how much inspiration buying art gave, and also how much fun it was to be in the art world, and they connected with certain pieces. And then 3 years later, those people had become collectors, and they would bring their friends. So it was this kind of ripple effect. But after 15 years, the ripples get pretty big, in the same way that going to Hong Kong gave us a much deeper understanding of Asia, and gave Asia a much deeper understanding of us. I think coming here to Buenos Aires will give us a much deeper understanding of Latin America.
Moving away from the city's house on the majestic Basso Bilbasso Avenue and towards the neighbourhood of Via Crespo, dozens of new galleries are opening. The area has become central to Buenos Aires's burgeoning contemporary art scene. Gallerist Nora Fish, one of the first to arrive, explains the changes that are taking place.
The contemporary art scene in Buenos Aires is truly exciting. There has been a huge development over the past 4 or 5 years where certain art institutions that were not very active or not very interesting got took over by new directors and by new curators. And there's been a revamping of all the programming in those art institutions. There's also a new art gallery scene with many new young alternative spaces popping up all over the place. I believe things are really happening right now and that the scene has a high level of sophistication, both on an intellectual and a sensitive level. And I want to believe that this somehow is like New York was in the 70s, in the sense that our art market is not that strong, at least not yet. There's a very small collector base, but there's a lot of production and a lot of activities. You could be going to an opening almost every night. There are performances, gatherings, parties. It's really very happening right now.
Local artists, however, are hoping that as well as being a megaphone for the modern Argentine art scene, that the arrival of Art Basel could also help ease some of the difficulties when it comes to commercialising their work. Getting pieces physically in and out of Argentina is still an onerous process, with high levels of tax and a complex licensing system. Cynthia Cohen is one of Buenos Aires' most recognised contemporary painters. I meet her at her studio to the south of the city.
I feel that there's something productive and very good about having Basel in my city, but it needs to be accompanied by a system or a view that a piece of art has value in its own right. A few years ago, we were in a different situation. There was a different political situation. Today, with Basel on the scene and with a group of galleries that are really trying to make significant changes to the way art here is commercialized, to the way as an artist you can display your work abroad without it being an impossible process to take it out of the country, we hope that this initiative helps a little with that. But on top of this, for me, it's also about believing that our art and culture has real value, that it can be quantifiable for a city and for a country. Most countries believe in what they produce. But here, there's a bit more speculation over this. I don't feel that the Argentinians have really 100% believed in the value art brings.
Artists are hoping that the arrival of Basel will be a first step towards helping Argentina commercialise its contemporary artwork outside of the country. And city dwellers are hopeful that after years of isolation, Buenos Aires is returning to the global city stage. For Monocle, in BA, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Thanks, Lucinda. Well, elsewhere in Buenos Aires, there's plenty more going on too. Last year, the annual Night of Museums received more than 1 million visitors, and the latest edition was even bigger, with 260 cultural spaces on the books, welcoming guests until 3 a.m. From historic buildings to galleries, schools and universities, there was a huge variety on offer, as Frederick Bernas for Monocle sent this report.
For one night only, the Terreno Audiovisual Art Collective have free rein to create whatever they can imagine. The group has taken over an entire floor of the Casa Nacional del Bicentenario, a cultural centre at the heart of Buenos Aires. This live performance from Bosques sin Árboles is based around an installation that intervenes in the permanent exhibition. It's focused on a piano attached to an acoustic listening box, which is transformed into a glowing red shrine for a make-believe pagan god that combines elements of Christianity, Islam, and local folk traditions.
We make art that is usually connected to Argentinian roots and has something to do with common popular Argentinian expressions.
That's Tomás Bonilla, one half of the duo.
We decided to create our own image of a virgin. This was the Virgin of Racua. So it's the Virgin Mary wearing a niqab, and it instantly creates this contrast and this effect. We tried to do it in the most respectful way. That was really important to to us, because a lot of people thought it was Muslim imagery, but at the same time it was Christian. So if you want to present your own deity, it was, in my opinion, better to present it as a work of art, because we're already saying this is not real. We're not arguing that we've seen a vision of this Virgin. We're not arguing that this actually exists. We're saying this is a concept.
Tomás is producing this haunting soundscape by remixing samples from classical pieces with electronic effects, while his partner, Nacho Ajerza, projects live visuals behind the installation. Other interventions include a performance which uses motion sensors inside another artwork to create sonic sequences that boom out in the main hall. There's also an interactive listening room, which connects visitors with an artist in Mexico, and a rave area illuminated with strips of green light. Downstairs, two floors of the Casa del Bicentenario host an exhibition which is part of the Bienal Sur, a wide-ranging new Biennale for South America, centered in Buenos Aires. With shows in 32 cities and 16 countries, it aims to put the region on the world map of contemporary art, forging links between neighboring nations which do not interact as much as they could, preferring to look towards the United States and Europe. Members of the Terreno Collective appreciate their chance to reach an audience which generally views art in formal surroundings, like the Biennale. Sergei Kolesov and Nacho Ajerza say that many people make a special effort for the Night of Museums every year.
That was an interesting thing to participate in with the crew, because we were exposed to really like normcore people who actually just go to museums when they have to go because it's the night of the museums.
It's like your grandma entering the MoMA for the first time. It's like she will be like, why all this bunch of people are looking at a paper in the floor? But at that night, she will pay attention to that paper on the floor.
The vibrant cultural world of Buenos Aires has many dimensions, and the crossover between the independent and institutional art scenes was fascinating to observe at the Night of Museums. With projects like the Bienal Sur looking to raise the city's international profile, underground movements like Terreno may get more opportunities to widen their public, presenting adventurous works like the Deity installation. But museums, curators, and cultural gatekeepers must be careful to strike a balance between opening a global marketplace and nourishing local creativity at the roots. Both sides are equally important for a thriving artistic landscape. For Monocle, in Buenos Aires, I'm Frederick Bernas.
Thanks to Frederick Bernas for that report from Buenos Aires. Now, of course, it wouldn't be the Monocle Arts Review if we didn't have a check-in with Fernando Augusto Pacheco on a global countdown from somewhere in the world. Sarah, Anne, have you both been privy to one of Fernando's rundowns before?
I have, yes.
This is my first.
Okay, well, we're in for
I hope
treat,
I don't disappoint you.
Where are we heading today, Faye?
We're going to Canada, which...
Canada.
Again, it's a country that we cover a lot here at Monocle. We have our office in Toronto. But, you know, so far, because the problem with Canada, the Canadian charts, they're very similar to the American ones. So I was waiting for a week where the Canadian number one is different from the American. And we have...
And finally it's happened. I mean, Canada's an interesting choice because, obviously, this is a country that invests so much in its musicians, doesn't it? I mean, we think of Drake and so on. They get direct support from the government to push them out there as soft power exports.
No, absolutely. It's very important. And in fact, to be honest, I mean, the top five today, there's no Canadian artists, but you had so many of them, like Justin Bieber, especially Justin Bieber, actually, doing very well. And it's a very recent chart. I think Billboard started doing that in 2007. So before that, I don't think they had like an official chart. And their first number one was Umbrella by Rihanna.
So
a little trivia here.
A bit of background for you. Number five then, Fernando.
Number five is an interesting one, and I would like to correct myself to listeners because it's J Balvin and Willie William with Mi Gente. But this time, I did mention last week that actually they didn't have any featuring like Despacito had with Justin Bieber. But actually, they do have a featuring. It's Beyoncé, you know? So basically, she decided... Mi Gente was a major reggaeton hit already all over the world. But I think Beyoncé decided to do like a little remix and add a few kind of lines to the song. And she's giving all the money to charity as well for the hurricane relief in Puerto Rico and Mexico. And
one on your playlist, Fernando? Do you like
it? I do. I mean, the beat is very infectious. I mean, if you haven't heard Mi Gente, I recommend.
In four?
Number four, for example, I wouldn't recommend number four. But I'm sorry, maybe Anne and Sarah. It's Ed Sheeran with Perfect. It's the fourth single of his album, Divide. And I have to say, I mean, the guy is extremely successful. Not many artists these days have a fourth single in the charts, you know? It's, I mean, kudos for him. It's not Shape of You. It's a very slow ballad. And yeah.
It's a no from Fernando there. Number three?
Number three, that's a funny one. I never heard of him before. It's Lil Pump. He's a 17-year-old rapper from Miami. And the song is called Gucci Gang. One thing I have to say about that is that... It's the power of Gucci. I mean, Alessandro Michele did an excellent job with Gucci because he's there. He's part of the pop culture kind of world. And there's, I mean, the lyrics are quite naughty. I'm not going to say them here. But the refrain is like, Gucci gang, oh, you know. So it's...
A masterclass.
That tells us so much, Fernando.
Yeah. I didn't say he's 17 as well. So.
And in number two.
And number two, Post Malone featuring 21 Savage. It's Rockstar. Again, a rap song that is doing very well. I think that's a little bit better than Gucci Gang.
And for the top spot, Fernando, I'm right in saying that the video for this one is one quite close to your heart, isn't it? It's got a sort of telenovela edge to it, hasn't it?
Yes, indeed. It's so funny. It's such a funny video. Basically, it's Camila Cabello featuring Young Thug. And, you know, she's playing a little bit of a character in the video, saying, like, you know, this girl who doesn't like to go out and like to watch telenovelas. And then her grandma said, you know what, you should go out and, you know, try to... find love. And
where does she tell her to go to? To Havana?
To Havana and to a dance floor, actually. Okay. That's what the grandma wanted.
Should we hear a little sample from that then?
Absolutely.
Quite the change of pace there from the rest of the Monocle Arts review, but I enjoyed it, Fernando. A favourite of yours?
It's a cool track. I love it. And you know what? I like it, actually. First of all, Camila Cabello, she left Fifth Harmony, the girl group she used to be. And now she's number one. You know, she did a Harry Styles or Jerry Hello, you know. So sometimes going solo can work. And she's Cuban-American as well. So I think she's coming back to her roots a little bit. Nice. And the video is very funny, as you mentioned. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, it's a good...
I like it. Yeah, it makes you want to leave the house and go to the dance floor, definitely. Yeah.
And then listen to the Gucci Gang.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks very much to my guests, Sarah Shafi and Anne Meadows. This show is produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'm Chris Lord. To play us out, let's have some more of that Canadian number one. Camila Cabello and Young Thug, this is Havana. Jeffrey, just graduated fresh on campus. Fresh out east and loud, no way, no mountain. Fresh out east and loud, up on board like a traffic jam.